Welcome to Victoria Rumble Room, an island show that endeavors to peel the onion on the issues here, there, and everywhere. I'm Robin Adair, and speaking of everywhere, across town, my co-host with the most, the Croatian sensation himself, John Jurisic, and Johnny. Somehow, miraculously, we both managed to get away for very short Mexico holidays with our families.
It's great to get some sun, Robin, but I must say, a little too much food. Perhaps a little bit too much liquor. Glad to be back in the saddle. On top of that, it was great to know that we had the Rumble Room Express loaded up so that we could keep the train running, and we're now fully back in the saddle. Unfortunately, we have to start off with a goodbye to former Progressive Conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who passed away at the age of 84.
That's right, John. It is a sad passing, losing a long battle with cancer, and you know, love him or hate him, and there were people that certainly were not happy about him, particularly at the end of his long tenure as prime minister, a couple of massive majorities. No one would argue that Brian Mulroney left a very strong mark on Canada.
Man, oh man, did he ever. I remember him throwing an opening pitch at a David Foster charity softball game at Royal Athletic Park, of all places. He and his wife, Mila, always loved a crowd. Brian Mulroney was a man of vision back in the 1980s and pushed through several measures that have really had long-lasting positive effects on our Canadian community. He was the push behind the original Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, which later led to NAFTA that included Mexico. He was also responsible for the GST, whether that's good or bad. That was the goods and services tax, which remains in place to this day. He also brought in acid rain legislation and other environmental laws. He won landslide victories. But in the wake of failing to upgrade the Constitution at Meech Lake and Charleston, he left under a cloud.
Yeah, the Charlottetown Agreement, we all hoped it was going to go through, I think, because they wanted to bring Quebec into the Constitution, because originally when Pierre Elliott Trudeau brought the Constitution back, the British North America Act, back to Canada, Quebec wouldn't sign on. Mulroney tried to change that. It just never happened. And one other note, and it's a happy note here, something that I think a lot of people don't know is that he is responsible. Brian Mulroney is responsible for the giant career success, the skyrocketing career of Michael Bublé. He'd heard Michael Bublé, and he decided this young man can sing, and he invited him to come and sing at his daughter's wedding. And guess who was there to listen to the concert? Was one Bruce Allen, who signed him up, and the rest is history. Michael Bublé has a career, at least in part, because of Brian Mulroney.
What a great story. That's good. Brian Mulroney, therefore, certainly left a mark on numerous ways. And I guess the same might be said now about David Eby's BC government, as it's unveiled a budget featuring a massive deficit and a long list of promises and pre-election goodies.
No kidding, John. You know, David Eby and the NDP have unveiled a budget with a $7.9 billion deficit. That's the biggest by far in BC history. And that certainly got some people talking.
And big time spending too, Robin. The spending will increase by $4 billion, reaching $18.8 billion, which is mostly taxpayer-supported money. So here's some reaction.
Everyone wants a decent home in the community they love, and we all need access to quality health care, including a family doctor.
We're getting the worst outcomes we've ever seen in health care, in public safety, in drug overdose death rates, in housing affordability, in every area that the provincial government's responsible for. We're seeing the worst results we've ever seen.
How could this be with a government that has increased its spending by 70% since 2017? It's running over an $8 billion deficit this year alone.
I'd like to think the budget is the story that's catching everyone's eye. But Robin, how about that little bit of woke language from our NDP-led government, telling us how we should identify ourselves going forward? And I now quote, "The term British Columbian is often used to reference people living in BC. This term excludes Indigenous peoples who may not identify with it. For many, They identify as members of their own sovereign nations and do not consider themselves part of Canada that has actively worked to assimilate their people. British Columbians also exclude other groups, such as newcomers and refugees. We recommend instead saying people living in BC, and that is the end of a rather awkward quote, frankly. We wonder what former Heisla chief and Skeena MLA Ellis Ross thinks of cancel culture as well. He's on record that he's a proud Canadian and British Columbian.
We're doing communities a disservice, and that goes for the cancel culture, tearing down statues. But why do you want to erase history? Why don't you just add to that history and just say, well, yeah, you might have done some bad things, you might have done some good things, but here's the truth of it all. But don't erase anybody's history, whether it be First Nations or non-First history. That's not doing anybody any favors.
You know, John, that was a government release, and I really felt it was demeaning to our First Nations. These are proud people. They work very hard for the people on their reserves, for the many people that are Indigenous that don't live on reserves. And the ones that I've dealt with, First Nations people I've worked with and dealt with over the years, are proud of where they come from. They're proud of being part of a First Nation. And from my experience, they're very proud of being British Columbians and Canadians. I think this all does them a disservice. And again, it's the woke movement, I believe, showing its cards. And if you'll indulge me for a minute, I'd like to briefly address this entire woke culture that seems to be permeating our own, where it came from, what it means. We'd all like to know maybe why we're being collectively accused somehow, because we're white, of being racists, of being oppressors. So here now is an outline, a very quick outline, of critical theory. Critical theory is the philosophy behind the woke movement in Canada. And we draw our information from the book, The 1867 Project, Why Canada Should Be Cherished, Not Cancelled, produced by the Aristotle Think Tank. So drawing from this resource, let's quickly look at the roots of wokeism, critical theory, which really first became well known during the Great Depression in the 1930s. Critical theory casts European Caucasian people as somehow oppressors, that they are the oppressors in a system. Virtually everyone else, therefore, is oppressed. Critical theory also condemns capitalism as the tool of Western oppression. Critical theory doesn't accept that everyone is entitled to different opinions or to the open debate of ideas. Far left, and I mean far left, I don't believe that everybody who is on the left side of our political spectrum shares all of this. I'm saying people who are really on the far left and committed to it are apt to insist that truth is all relative, and when they encounter facts they don't like, they reject them and enforce the truth they prefer without debate. Critical theory believes people are not unique individuals, but members of identity groups, including race and gender. Oppression defines the relationships between these groups. Again, critical theory states that straight, able-bodied, white males reside at the very top of this whole privilege pyramid. And underneath that, right underneath it, are white women, and then other racial groups, and they're all in strata going down. And increasingly, as we move down that strata in this pyramid, people are oppressed. Critical race theory believes that systemic racism, and that system-wide racism, is embedded in our culture. And all of this is through capitalism. And here's what Mark Milkey from the Aristotle Foundation has to say about the labeling of people who immigrated to Canada from Europe, labeling them as settlers and colonists.
The problem with this language actually is also it's just historically and evolutionarily wrong. You know something? With respect, all of us are settlers, right? We all came from Africa, millions of years ago, and people have migrated across the world. There's no pure indigenous culture or society anywhere on the planet. We've all, eventually, our ancestors came from somewhere else, and ultimately all of us came from Africa. That's the evolutionary origins of the human species. It's a mistake to divide people in the 21st century based on whether you got here 5 years ago, maybe you came from Hong Kong, you know, or 80 years ago from Ukraine, fleeing Joseph Stalin, or if your ancestors came across the Bering Strait 20,000 years ago.
For the record, I stand, I believe, with the vast majority of Canadians who welcome immigration and diversity. And we believe it only strengthens and diversifies and enriches our culture in Canada. However, critical theory believes it is racist to deny the advantage of white privilege or claim to be colorblind. So, for example, by just the virtue of me discussing this on this program right now, I am showing my own evidence of privilege, power, and racism. So when you see signs like this that suggest we've stolen land and are settlers and colonists, and that the founders of our country, like Sir John A. Macdonald, should be erased from history, that history should be rewritten and statues should tumble, I say to all of that, nonsense. Sure, in the light of day, let's dig into the facts and debate these issues. That's what you do in a free society. Imposing ideas and dogma without debate is not freedom.
Robin, you know, we're seeing various ways that wokeism has seeped into our society, including in government announcements. See aspects of wokeism at every level of society, particularly government. A recent example of this is federal Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault, who recently said that there would be no more federal money for new roads or transportation infrastructure. Sometimes, Rob, and I read this stuff and it's hard to believe I'm saying it. He happens to live in Montreal and rides around on a bike. I ride around on a bike, but we still need roads. We still need infrastructure. So good for him. But this isn't realistic. And the Liberals have quickly backpedaled after getting hammered, as they should, by premiers, mayors, social media, and the mainstream press.
And it permeates in all sorts of different ways, John. You've got to love NDP Member of Parliament Charlie Angus. He's so down right now on oil and gas industry in general. He's talked about changing the federal law to actually jail oil and gas executives who dare to say good things about their industry. Mm. So, you know, that's crazy. Our natural resource sector is one of the biggest economic drivers in the country. So sure, by all means, let's clean up the environment. Let's find a better way and a cleaner way to work with our resources and to try to be responsible Canadians. But let's not bury the industry while we're at it.
Right on. And staying with your bury it theme, we want to dig deeper into the whole energy issue and where Canada's heading. Dan McTeague was a longtime federal member of parliament who once battled the oil and gas sector over price gouging, but now stands up for oil, gas, LNG, hydro, and nuclear power, which he believes are still all very necessary, even as we slowly shift to green energy. So you know what? Let's zoom him in.
And now joining us in the Rumble Room, all the way from Milton, Ontario, is the man behind Canadians for Affordable Energy, Dan McTeague. And it's great to have you on the show.
Good to be here in the Rumble Room with you, Robin. Thank you.
We're going to do some good rumbling here. So much ground to cover. And perhaps we could start with some energy doublespeak. We keep hearing about the burning of fossil fuels as destroying the planet. Now, this is something we hear commonly from scientists. We hear it from politicians all the time. We have city officials who are campaigning, at least they're certainly campaigning in places like Victoria, that everybody should get out of their cars, get in buses, ride bicycles, stop destroying the planet. They're on a moral crusade. And on top of this, we're told by our provincial and federal governments, they're determined to reach zero carbon by what, 2050, I think, at the outside, and rapidly and immediately moving towards green energy on so many fronts as an alternative to fossil fuel. So I guess my question in all of this, what's true in your mind, and what's a falsehood in this energy debate?
Well, I think we can begin with the fact that without energy, we wouldn't be having this discussion, and we wouldn't be enjoying perhaps of all the generations that preceded us an unparalleled standard of living. Hydrocarbons are very much a part and an important part of our development as a nation and our success as a civilization. And to deny that or to ignore that while not taking into account the great strides that have been made to manage and to harvest and to harness those energies responsibly, I think does a disservice not only to the truth, but really reflects on those who are engaged in the attack and the narrative that says fossil fuels bad and somehow green energies can appear out of nowhere to substitute, not to complement, but to substitute the energy menus that we need to continue to survive as a civilization. And I suspect that it has a lot more to do with maybe a positive approach. Those of us who understand that we have responsibilities to generations, to civilization, and to our future recognize, the importance of energy. And in order to get that energy, you can't really run current to the laws of physics and in thermodynamics, much as many of these so-called scientists would like us to do. At the end of the day, perhaps a better discussion, a more realistic discussion that puts people first and takes into account the great strides that have been made in a country like Canada, which is very much a world leader when it comes to the management, the stewardship of its resources like energy.
Are we moving towards cleaner energy, though? This is the thing that was brought up. Is it realistic we could be at net zero by 2050 or even 2030? You hear about that as well. Are these realistic goals that are being set? What in your mind is the answer here for people who, we hear it all the time. People are always talking about, I've got myself an electric car. I'm doing my bit. I've got a bicycle. I'm going to stop driving my vehicle. We're going to save the planet because, we're destroying it. We're destroying it every day. What do you say to people like that?
Well, I'd say to people like that to get real and to look at the bigger picture and to recognize that I'm in Ontario. I represented a riding which happened to be the first in North America to build the largest commercial nuclear reactors, which are still running, by the way, and still providing about 60-65% of our energy needs. Does electrification by a certain period of time work? I think in a country like ours, you can't have a political agenda superimposed over a reality construct in which you're saying, well, we're going to get rid of everything we have, everything's going to be electric and everything's going to be fine. By the way, how is electricity working for those in Cape Breton these days? You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket in a country like Canada. But as far as Canada being clean, here's a medallion. When I was an MP for Pickering, medallion says Pickering Township, Ontario, Canada, to commemorate sod turning of North America's largest nuclear power plant, September 11th, 1965. We've been clean for a long time. Some people will disagree with that. That's fine. But we have, as a country, harnessed our ability to to use our resources responsibly. Some coal, some hydropower, some nuclear power, some propane, some natural gas. But in a country as diverse as ours, the coldest in the planet, by the way, you kind of want to have that because not one size fits all. And if you put all your eggs in one electrification basket, you might wind up short of energy. More importantly, you got $3 or $4 trillion. Last time I checked, the country hasn't got that ability to pay that out to achieve what? Some pure goal that someone says, well, we can somehow change the amount of CO2 in the air. Because if that's all we're looking for, I really want to have a more sober discussion of 0.04% of which mankind is responsible for 3%, of which Canada is 1.4%. That would be like me taking, the Lionsgate Bridge and saying, hey, because we found a grain of dirt on it, we're going to rip the whole bridge down.
Okay, that actually frames the answer for a question I'm going to ask. And so perhaps, I'll play the devil's advocate here. First of all, great to have you on the program, Dan. I understand you were a federal Liberal member of parliament for 18 years and at times went after big oil and gas for price gouging. So to be clear, you're not working for big oil and gas. So if this is the case, and from the perspective of the fact that most of us Canadians sort of live in a political middle, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, isn't it a good thing for solar panels to be going up on buildings and homes and electric vehicles to be rapidly appearing on our streets? Kind of the more holistic picture. Where do you fall on that?
Well, the liberal in me always says, I'm not a big fan of the oil companies, not a big fan of mine. When I predict gas prices for people in Vancouver and BC and right across the country a couple of days in advance, they lose a lot of money. And I think there's days that they'd love me to shut my trap. But I believe that the industry is extremely important, not just because of what it produces, but because of what revenues come from it and the great economic impetus. If you can take 10 to 12% of your GDP and throw it in the garbage and do without, great, wonderful. But last time I checked, that wouldn't just put us in a recession, that put us in a depression. The rest of the world is asking Canada to step up to the plate. We have the third largest provable reserves of oil in the world, five or six when it comes to natural gas. If Canada doesn't get these products to market, then countries like Russia, Venezuela, Iran will be more than too happy to do it for us. Or our friends south of the border who love the fact that we've hogtied our infrastructure so that they can continue to beat us at the punch on LNG. And by the way, we had 17 projects on the paper. We had them well before the Americans even thought about this. We sat back, we dawdled, we hummed and hawed. We were the proverbial nice people and dithering as much as we can. The Americans built 7 LNG. They're supplying Europe and they're keeping the world a much safer place. Unfortunately for Canada, and I think for a lot of Canadians, we tend to overlook the importance of the bounty that we have, and it should be used responsibly, as I mentioned earlier, John.
You know, we grew up in a time, and I can think this is true for all three of us, we grew up in a time when we were told all the time that Canada was one of the most bountiful places in the world to live, and one of the reasons we had so much wealth was because of resources. And we had a lot of great natural resources that we could use in industry. We had, of course, the strength of the dollar at that time. Remember when our dollar was on par, even a little bit more valuable than the US dollar. And you have to think that was linked somehow to that. Natural resources created massive employment. And that came from energy of all types, like mining, forestry, of course, the energy sector into, as you mentioned, nuclear, oil, and hydro. And, you know, it's today people are wondering why our inflation is so high and why our dollar is so low. And so how much could you trace to our national energy policy in explaining why we are struggling on so many fronts with our economy?
Well, when you have your two greatest friends and allies knocking on your door asking for LNG and for some natural gas and maybe a bit of oil, Germany and Japan last year, and you say there's no business case for it, and they go out and sign multi-billion dollar deals, you kind of have to ask yourself why we wouldn't have stepped up to the plate and said, maybe we could provide it. They asked us first. We said no. There are consequences for these things. And I think the reality is that one of the biggest ones, which is inflationary, is the value of the Canadian dollar, which you alluded to. The last time we had $70-$80 oil in, you know, the year period between 2007 and 2013, because I do these things every day, I benchmark, and I know the importance of the value of the Canadian dollar. Every single commodity that we consume in Canada, whether it is made here or imported, is priced and denominated in US dollars. The fact that we have nothing of interest that the world wants to buy, unless, of course, we're prepared to subsidize it to the hilt with borrowed tax dollars. Because we have that, we have a weak Canadian dollar. In the case of gasoline, it adds 22 cents a liter to the price of gasoline, 24 for diesel. You can imagine that all the imported goods that you bring from California, again, in U.S. terms, and people wonder, well, why are prices so high? Forget the fact that the federal government has not one but two carbon taxes. You in B.C. have the BC low carbon fuel standard, which is 17 cents on a liter of gasoline, something the previous Horgan government called mystery dollars. I challenged them and damn it, I was right. It was in the RIAS, the federal government's regulatory impact analysis statement, actually said for every $100 of carbon, it's 4 cents a liter, $110 for it's 4 cents. If you extrapolate that and you figure we've just made life a lot more difficult for Canadians, we've achieved absolutely nothing other than a virtue signal. It's great. I work in foreign affairs. I represent the country in the consular dimension. Wonderful to go in other countries and sit back Perrier and eat canapes. But at the end of the day, if Canadians can't make ends meet, it's pretty shameful. Politicians should be the last ones to celebrate something they've done when they've destroyed our ability to make ends meet. And in Canada, I know people tiptoe around it. Affordability has now become the number one issue. When I left Gas Buddy in 2017, 2018, I came back to Canada saying we've got a real problem here. Canada's the, you know, the scapegoat for all these fanatics and their ideas. They're going to kill the economy. They're going to make it impossible for Canadians to live. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. But it's amazing to see how many people tiptoe around the idea that affordability is not the issue. It is the issue, and it's the issue on which I think the next federal government, the next federal election will be waged. And I know for sure my old party, the Liberal Party, will go down in a significant defeat.
Dan, our former mayor in Saanich, local municipality here on Lower Vancouver Island, Fred Haynes, is working with a Canadian company as part of a worldwide effort to convert carbon into building materials like cement. They're currently piloting this technology in buildings, but there are plans to do much more. Can the fossil fuel industry be decarbonized? And would this change the doomsday forecasts that we hear from scientists?
Well, I think we hear doomsday forecasts changing. They alter it every season. There's always another doomsday scenario. But weather's weather and climate's climate. And, you know, I have spoken to a number of serious experts who tell me that the moment mankind and scientists can figure out the relationship of all the layers of the atmosphere and their interrelationship is the day we'll start to have things on the law of climate in a Newtonian sense. So, yes, we have applications and we are using sulfur. We are using carbon for other purposes. So their extraction is great. But I guess I'm one of those who, old school, I'm married to a dentist. I have a family of scientists who all tell me it's an inert gas and without which you would not survive. And so when we're saying, 0.04% is a bad thing, you know, at 0.28, we would actually start to die. Our plants and our flora and fauna would begin to disappear. So I think we have to be very careful. I'm not one of those that goes out and cheers the fact that we have CO2 emissions, but for a country like Canada that has found ways to sequester, to capture, and is doing this in provinces like Saskatchewan, put your money where your mouth is. The federal government should be there working with the provinces, working with the business to get those things to happen, rather than clubbing every Canadian over the head with a stupid carbon tax, which is nothing more than a revenue generator for government so they can make big fat announcements and look after their woke constituencies.
Well, let's talk about provincial politics. And in BC, of course, we're always being dazzled with some of the ideas of our NDP government when it comes to energy. We have had quite a few debates about whether we want pipelines. There was a time when John Horgan, when he was premier, said he'd use every tool in his toolbox to stop the pipeline that was going to come down to Port Moody. And at the end of the day, it went through. They were going to oppose the pipelines that were going to bring LNG to the coast, but then they became champions of it. And originally, they wanted to stop the Site C dam as well. And now that's going forward. And thank goodness, because now they're trumpeting the importance of switching over to hydro. The premier, David Eby, our new premier, actually he's been there for a while now, he just met with the energy sector in Prince George, and he announced that hydrogen power is the big thing. There's going to be a hydrogen power plant built in Prince George. It's going to power the pulp mill there. It's going to create jobs. On top of it, $36 billion is being promised for a hydro infrastructure over the next 10 years. So lots is going on. The premier says there has been a misconception that a cleaner future is at odds with the resource industry. He says that's simply not true. So in your mind, what do you think the premier's strategy is in all this?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a little bit of following his cousin in Ottawa. I mean, you have, it's great to talk about the process of which hydrogen we're talking about. If it's going to be through natural gas, that's wonderful. BC has plenty of it. I'm sure Fortis will be very happy. But I think we have to be very careful. If the cost of producing hydrogen is double the energy that you're going to produce, then it becomes more than a zero-sum game. You're actually losing every time you produce a unit. It becomes a little bit counterintuitive. If, however, we're talking about electrolysis of hydrogen using hydro, well, that's extraordinarily expensive. And beyond the expense, the question is, who's going to pay for it? More importantly, what happens when you have a couple of dry seasons like you've had currently and your water dams don't work? And I'm not talking drying out water beds. I'm talking a small 1% or 2% decrease in the amount of precipitation could have a significant impact on your ability to produce those things. Again, I think the dynamic and the strength of the nation is the diversity of energy options so that you don't just put one and say to the detriment of all the others. And, you know, we've talked hydrogen, we've talked fuel cell. I worked for Toyota Canada Public Relations. One of the first things I did when I was there was do the Cutlines media for a little car called the Tsunami. You know, today is the Prius, the Cutline, I remember because I wrote it. was this would be 30, 50 year technology, and it's still there. In fact, hydrogen, or rather hybrid vehicles, on a per kilometer, per mile basis, are as efficient in terms of their environmental impact as an EV. And so we're getting to the point now, I think we have to get a little smarter about what we're doing and recognize the technologies that are there have brought us to this point. But you don't want to throw any one of those forms of energy away, because we know, you know, our energy needs transform rapidly and suddenly. You can have cold weather or extreme warm weather. In either case, you need to have the flexibility of a dynamic energy system that is able to respond nimbly. And unfortunately, having only one type, hydrogen electricity, isn't going to cut it for most Canadians unless they want to live in squalor.
Great to hear from Dan McTeague. And no doubt in a day, and maybe in the not too distant future, but certainly in the future, we'll have a much greener environment, a greener economy, and greener energy. But in the shorter term, fossil fuel is going to continue to play an important role in Canada. It's going to be important for our economy. It's going to be important when dealing with all this debt and deficits. We need it. So we must improve our technology, but we can't afford to destroy our economy. And if the new energy isn't quite ready yet, we have to move on still and work with what we have. And on that happy note, Johnny, it's pretty well time to wrap up another Rumble Room.
It certainly is. I think we're both feeling a lot of energy after a nice little holiday. What a fascinating show. Thank you, Robin. Loved that we dug into the entire whole woke mindset. Loved the historical context from that. It's important that we talk about this. Discussing the ideas, as you mentioned, core of our democracy. It's what we do. It's what we do in the VRR. And something that we, you know, clearly people like to hear in the Rumble Room. And we appreciate that those folks are telling other folks, and they're all tuning in. And you could follow our show in so many ways, on Facebook, on X, on YouTube. You could listen to us on audio. You can watch us on Instagram. I've even got us on TikTok. Oh my gosh. So I remain proudly Canadian and British Columbian, especially after coming back from Mexico, and I'm also Croatian. My name's John Jurisic.
And I'm Robin Adair, very proud of being part of a long history of people coming to Canada and North America from around the world over many centuries to build a great nation and rumble on.